Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
So good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
It seems like the sound is fine. So I want to thank you, Les, for inviting me to speak tonight. I'll just say a little bit more about myself. My current role at San Francisco Zen Center is the liaison for the Branching Streams Sanghas, which are sanghas in the Suzuki Roshi lineage. All sanghas and Zen centers all around the U.S. and in other countries. And there are about 70 in the U.S. and 9 in other countries, in Europe and Mexico and South America. So it's partly because of that I was invited to come tonight, and really appreciate the warm welcome that I've received. And I hope that my comments tonight will touch a chord for some of you, and that you will find some resonance in what I have to say. So I thought a lot about what to speak about tonight, since it is my first time here and I've only met a few of your Sangha members. But I've been continually inspired by Suzuki Roshi's teachings, and so I thought I would go back to Suzuki Roshi. And the title of my talk tonight is Beginner's Mind, the Mind of Freedom. And I will start with some of Suzuki Roshi's teaching about beginner's mind, which may be very familiar to some of you. And share a couple of poems as part of my talk, and also talk about the relevance of that teaching to our lives and to the world today. I really value this teaching, which I keep coming back to. So how many of you have read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind? Parts of it? Almost everybody. Great. Yeah, it's a book that I find every time I read it, I find something new in it. And I know some people came to Zen practice, maybe not in this group, but some people come to Zen practice after reading that book. It's very inspiring. Suzuki Roshi describes beginner's mind as non-dualistic and limitless. And he says the goal of practice is always to keep our beginner's mind, which isn't so easy. He says our original mind includes everything within itself. It is always rich and sufficient within itself. You should not lose your self-sufficient state of mind. This doesn't mean a closed mind, but actually an empty mind and a ready mind. If your mind is empty, it is always ready for anything. It is open to everything. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. So he writes about how it can be very easy to have beginner's mind when you're doing something for the first time, or perhaps the first time you sit on a cushion. Often people have a really deep experience of meditation and then try to come back to that, and it may not be the same. I mean, it's usually not the same every time. But when we do things over and over again, it's harder to keep our beginner's mind and do things on automatic pilot or by rote. And how to keep that freshness of mind is challenging. And not only is that true about ideas, you know, can we meet ideas in a fresh, other people's ideas in a fresh way? Can we also meet people we know in a fresh way each time, rather than you know, just thinking, you know, I know what I'm going to hear from someone, a good friend or a partner that I've had for many years, and forget that we all change, people change, and I may be surprised. So the character for mind, or shin, is also the word for heart. So as well as keeping a fresh mind and an open mind, can we also keep an open heart in various situations that we find ourselves in? Suzuki Roshi also says, in the beginner's mind, there is no thought, I have attained something. All self-centered thought limits our vast mind. So we aren't trying to eliminate all thoughts or to have a peak experience when we practice zazen. We're simply sitting with whatever arises and changes. And try to stay open to what the experience is from moment to moment. And Suzuki Roshi also calls beginner's mind the mind of compassion. When our mind is compassionate, it is boundless, he says. So I want to talk a little about how beginner's mind can help us meet new ideas with openness. At San Francisco Zen Center, we have a set of guidelines for multicultural interaction. They're called, what's sometimes thought of as communication guidelines. And one of those guidelines is try it on. So can we try on a new idea or a new way of doing things that we might not be familiar with? And not necessarily, you know, if you try something on, you're in a shop and you might try on a shirt, it doesn't mean you're going to take it home with you and wear it. You're just trying it on. So I think that's a helpful attitude when hearing an idea that might be new or that you might even disagree with. Can you, if you are in a conversation with someone who says something that, you know, startles you or that you actually think, well, no, I don't think that's true, can you try to understand that person's perspective before dismissing it? This is a communication guideline that I've been working with for several years, and because I a few years ago when I was working at Zen Center in the development department, I had a colleague who told me that I had she pointed out a tendency when she brought up a new idea about fundraising, that I almost always responded by saying why I didn't think it would work, and that was really difficult for her because it kind of stifled her creativity. So I've been really trying ever since to, when someone offers a new idea, to be willing to try it on and consider it and appreciate someone for offering a new idea or a fresh idea. And I think this same attitude of mind can also help us meet people freshly. It's when we are able to meet people with a beginner's mind, we can put aside some of our prejudgments. I think we're always, we make assumptions about people based on what the way they look or their speech or something about them that either we may find draws us to them, or perhaps we find we're not drawn, or we even want to avoid some people that we encounter. Can we approach people with a kind of curiosity? Who is this person? And what might we have in common? So there's a poem that I've recently come to love by Naomi Shihab Nye. Is anyone not familiar with Naomi Shihab Nye? Some of you know her. She's a poet who lives in San Antonio, Texas. She's written many books of poetry and also stories, and she's currently the Children's Poet Laureate. She does a lot of teaching of poetry in schools. And she comes to Tassajara every summer, Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, to offer a workshop with senior Dharma teacher Paul Haller on poetry and Zen. So that's where I first met her. Her father was Palestinian and her mother American. And during her youth, her family spent some time in Jerusalem. So she got to know her Palestinian family. And this is a poem called Red Brocade. The Arabs used to say, when a stranger appears at your door, feed him for 3 days before asking who he is, where he's come from, where he's headed. That way, he'll have strength enough to answer. Or by then, you'll be such good friends, you don't care. Let's go back to that. Rice, pine nuts. Here, take the red brocade pillow. My child will serve water to your horse. No, I was not busy when you came. I was not preparing to be busy. That's the armor everyone puts on to pretend they had a purpose in the world. I refuse to be claimed. Your plate is waiting. We will snip fresh mint into your tea. So what I appreciate about that poem is that it describes meeting a stranger with openness, with generosity, with hospitality, being a host, being warm and welcoming, without asking the usual questions one would ask, who the person is, where they're from, or where they're going. The host simply feeds the guest and lets them rest, offers them the best that they have, and puts aside business as usual. This is something we've been working on at San Francisco Zen Center. We used to have a reputation for people opening the door without smiling, looking down, you know, kind of bringing a very serious countenance. And many people didn't find that welcoming. The first time I entered City Center, it was not only I wasn't greeted quite that way, but it felt a little overwhelming to walk in. It's a very big building. It's a beautiful Julia Morgan design building, but it seemed very formal. And I think we're really trying now to find ways of being more welcoming to people who come to the door, greeting them warmly, inviting them in, and we're planning a redesign of the front of the building where we'll have an actual welcome center with tea and be able to invite people to sit down. And the bookstore will be part of that. And now when we have talks on Saturdays and a whole Saturday program followed by lunch, we have a newcomer's table at lunch so people have a chance to sit with a resident and ask questions and just feel there's someone they can talk to if they came by themselves. So we can also bring that kind of openness and friendliness, I think, to new ideas. And I think that open-hearted, open-minded way of meeting ideas and people is reflected in another phrase of Suzuki Roshi's that's well known. It's the phrase, "not always so." The second book of his talks is called "Not Always So." And he says the secret of Soto Zen is just two words, "not always so." Oops, three words in English. In Japanese, two words. "Not always so." This is the secret of the teaching. It may be so, but it is not always so. Without being caught by words or rules, without too many preconceived ideas, we actually do something, and doing something, we apply the teaching, he said. And that reminds me very much of the guideline, try it on. Not always so. I mean, I think many of us are raised to know, to want to know the right answer. We take tests where you are graded on knowing the right answer, to have that kind of mind where you admit you might not know, or you don't know, or maybe there's more to it than you think there is. I think it's another way of expressing this beginner's mind and the curiosity we can bring to things. So I find it is easy to have fixed ideas both about ourselves. I'm the kind of person who, until something happens and we realize, well, maybe that's not true. To have fixed ideas about other people, prejudgments about, and I find sometimes I have these thoughts or opinions about a new resident at Zen Center before I actually get to know them, and that these ideas can keep me from really just having a conversation and being curious about who this person is. So I want to share another poem that I wrote that has to do with an experience that I had when I was younger, where I began to see how having fixed ideas about people can really be hurtful. So this poem is called Carmelita. "I want to bring my new high school friend home to the Bronx, to the 8th-floor apartment in a fake brick building like all the others on Unionport Road. We walk past grandmothers speaking Yiddish, Italian, Gaelic, pushing carriages with blonde and brown-haired toddlers who turn with distaste from Carmelita, mi amiga, fluent in two languages. In the elevator, a woman pulls her daughter close to her side, eyeing Carmelita with tight eyes, her mouth a thin line. We stand at the door to 8D. Carmelita looks down, so I won't see her tears. I'm so sorry, I say, choking on my rage, knowing my words can't erase the stings of these women, all immigrants who see her as foreign, who don't see the narrowness of their own minds." So I wrote this poem recently after I learned that the neighborhood in which I grew up was called Parkchester. It was a neighborhood in the Bronx, a grouping of apartment buildings built by a company that intended it to be all white. And that was, I was, I mean, so all of the families were either Irish, Italian, Irish Catholic, Italian Catholic, or Jewish, and so the Catholic children all went to parochial schools, and the Jewish children went to the public school. And I didn't know that it was that the intention behind that apartment complex, there were many, many people who lived there, was that it be all white. And it wasn't until I went to high school, and I went to the High School of Music and Art, where there were children from all parts of the city, where I actually could have some friends who were from different cultural backgrounds. And my life opened up in some wonderful ways. So that early experience made me aware of the harm that prejudice, and particularly in this case racism, causes. And so in the summer before my senior year in college in 1963, I joined a voter registration project in Greensboro, North Carolina, sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee. And I was one of a group of 20 college students, black and white. We stayed, I'm just watching the time a little bit. We stayed in the basement of a black church and went out every day knocking on doors, registering people to vote. And in Greensboro, there had been sit-ins at Woolworth's, again, college students wanting to integrate the lunch counter. And that was the first time I was in the South and saw the effects of segregation. And at the end of our time at Greensboro, we all got on a bus, and we were at night. We left Greensboro escorted by the police, because I think at that time it was dangerous for a group of black and white people together to be on a bus. And we woke up in the morning in Washington, D.C., and were able to participate in the March on Washington, 1963. So I heard Dr. King, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, give his I Have a Dream speech. And I think that really influenced me deeply. And it helped me have a broader vision of how I would like the world to be and how I would like my community, my country to be. And it has kept me engaged. I mean, ever since I've been at Zen Center, I've been working on a committee that started out as the Diversity Committee. Now it's called the Diversity, Equity, Inclusivity, and Accessibility, DEIA, working group. And learning about my own unconscious bias and privilege as a white-skinned person. So, on Saturday, last week, we had a morning service to celebrate Dr. King's life, and we were able to broadcast in the Buddha Hall his voice reading his acceptance speech when he received the Nobel Prize. And it brought tears to my eyes every year we broadcast one of his speeches, and hearing his voice is still very poignant for me. So I wanted to share some words from that speech. He said, "I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America and an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I still believe that we shall overcome." And there was a lot more that he said. But, and I think that Martin Luther King was bringing beginner's mind, vast mind, limitless mind, compassionate mind to the problems in his community, in this country and the world. And he came from a place of love, which is, I feel, how, you know, it so important in these times when there's so much mistrust and hatred and creating walls, to remember our beginner's mind and our beginner's heart, our open heart, and to cultivate these qualities towards ourselves, one another, and all beings. So that's what I prepared for today. And is there time for questions?
Yes, of course.
Questions or comments? And if you would, when you speak, would you be willing to say your name?
Hi.
Hi.
My name's Lee.
Lee.
And I've heard about your programs, San Francisco Zen Center, to try and be more inclusive to different communities. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how that has been working for you and how you are welcoming people of every different kind of background, making them feel part of it. I think that's such an important aspect of our Buddhist communities.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. So we started having what we call affinity groups. And probably the first one was a meditation and recovery group. It's still going on. It meets every Monday night. And it's been going on for maybe 15 or 20 years. That's quite a long time. Then 10 years ago, another resident and I started a queer Dharma group, which meets once a month, and we just celebrated our 10th anniversary. This was the and we often march in the Pride Parade, and it's for everyone at all. It's at Green Gulch. People usually come with a truck, and people come up from Tassajara. That's been quite wonderful. We have a group, Zen in Espanol, that meets weekly. It's being led right now by a student who's from Argentina. And we have we have an Unpacking Whiteness group that meets monthly, which I co-lead with someone. We started out with a practice period class, 8 weeks long, and invited two teachers from the East Bay Meditation Center who were white to come, and another, David Zimmerman, who's now one of our abbots, and I assisted them, and then we started offering that group once a month for people who identify as white. So those are some of the groups that we have, and I know I can speak for Queer Dharma that it's a Dharma gate in a way, you know, that many people come for the first time to Zen Center, to any of those affinity groups, and then some of them keep coming and then begin coming to some of the other programs, and some people eventually move in. Oh, I forgot, one of the biggest groups is Young Urban Zen. We have a Young Urban Zen group for people in their 20s and 30s, and that has gotten to be really popular. I think that's been going on for 7 years, and sometimes there are 50 or 60 people in the Buddha Hall for that group, and they have day-longs at Green Gulch and other programs, and many of our residents now have come through Young Urban Zen. It's been really wonderful for Zen Center. So I see those. There's a wonderful book by Larry Yang, who was one of the guiding teachers at East Bay Meditation Center, called Awakening Together, talking about how important it is to have spaces that are inclusive, and how, you know, many Zen centers, and I would say, and now I'm visiting more of them around the country in our lineage, are primarily white, and how you know, I think what I'm learning is we have to look at what perpetuates that, and it's partly the culture that we are bringing that kind of dominates our Zen centers and makes it sometimes not very welcoming for people of other, not only, I think it's helpful also if Larry Yang writes about this, if you can see other people like yourself in a place, and we don't have very many teachers of color. So if people are looking for teachers or mentors who are people of color, it's hard to find them at Zen Center anyway. And there are some centers who are actively working on changing that. And I would say we are working on changing it, but it's a very slow process. So thank you for that question.
Thank you so much for your talk, Tova. My name is Dave. You started talking about beginner's mind and then later about Dr. King and the fact that you were able to actually be in Washington when he gave the I Have a Dream speech. Someone told me a story about that. Perhaps you know if this is true or not. Dr. King, of course, gave many wonderful speeches over the course of his life, but the most famous is the I Have a Dream speech. And the story that I heard was that he had actually, based on all of his experience and giving many speeches, he had prepared the works for that day. And someone who knew him very well said, "No, Martin, don't do that, because I speak from your heart." And the story was that the I Have a Dream speech was really just spoken extemporaneously. No notes, no preparation, he just said what was in his heart. So it seems to me that if there was ever an example of beginner's mind, that's probably a pretty good one.
Thank you very much for that story. Yeah. Well, you know, he was a preacher. He was a very powerful preacher. So I wouldn't be surprised if he just spoke from his heart that day. And I know he talked about his children wanting to be judged by the quality of their character, not the color of their skin. And he was very much, I can believe that.
Yeah. I'm Dan.
Hi, Dan.
What happened that sparked your interest in practice? Way back when you felt something and something was cracked in you and open in you, what galvanized your practice and what keeps it electrified?
Thank you for that question. I think the very first thing which I think predisposed me to practice maybe was winning a scholarship to play the cello when I was 10 years old. And I was given cello lessons for 3 years and then a cello, so I played all my life, but learning to listen and practicing, developing that, you know, that ability to practice every day and pay attention to what I was doing, I think may have predisposed me to meditation practice. But then we talked about this a little bit at dinner. When I was in high school, I started reading Thoreau and Emerson. I grew up in the city, in New York City, but in the summers, my families would sometimes be able to rent a bungalow in the Catskills. And my father taught me to swim, and then later I went to Girl Scout camp. And I was in what we called a pioneering unit. And we went on some 3-day hikes and canoe portages, and I developed this just great appreciation for nature. And I think then reading Thoreau and Emerson, I had a sense there was something, you know, bigger than my life, or that I wasn't separate from it, I was part of. And I think then when I was finally in my 30s, I went to Esalen to a Gestalt therapy workshop. I was a social worker at that time, and I had a colleague who was learning about Gestalt therapy. So I went to Esalen, and I saw someone meditating for the first time. And I also saw someone doing Tai Chi. Anyway, I was drawn to the stillness of that person sitting meditation. And then I started going to retreats at the Insight Meditation Society. And it was just, I think I've also always enjoyed silence. And you know, growing up in a very small apartment with two sisters, very little privacy, sometimes I could just find it inside myself. So that's, you know, many, I think many things drew me to practice. Wasn't one experience. And when I did start going to retreats, I also really appreciated the teachings. At that time it was Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein. It was the early days of the Insight Meditation Society, and they were wonderful teachers. And they brought some of their teachers from Burma and India and Thailand. So I was exposed to quite a few wonderful teachers. And then it wasn't until I moved to the Bay Area in 1990 that I met some Zen students through Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And there was something about them that I wanted to be like them. I was really drawn to their uprightness. One of them, Alan Sanaki, was one of them. You may not know him. He was at that time the director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and he still practices at Berkeley Zen Center. He's the co-abbot. And Susan Moon, who was also very active in the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. So I started going to Berkeley Zen Center in the mornings because I was living in the East Bay, and then to Green Gulch. And it was also, I liked the simplicity of the Zendo, and I felt very welcomed. And so gradually I kept spending more time at Green Gulch, and then started going to City Center, and then moved in, and then went to Tassajara, and then wanted to be a priest, and it just one thing led to another. But you know, when I started, I had no idea that meditation and Zen practice would be kind of become the focus of my life, which it is now. So it was very gradual. Thank you.
I would say that the focus of your life, the focus of my life is that crack that happened earlier on when you said you were out in nature and you had the sense of something greater. And the tendency that I found in myself is that I want to cover up that crack, that initial rawness, the seductiveness of the practice, and make it about some other thing than that which draws me and seduces me further. And that, I think, is the alarm bell of the practice, that you have that initial impetus, that the flower of the beginner's mind, and then immediately becomes something else. And not to let it become something else, I think, is the real rigor of the practice.
Is that what sustains you in your practice?
The thing that sustains me is what you said from the first, being out there in nature and having the sense that, wait a minute, there's something other than the way I'm seeing it through fixed views. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Sure. Yeah. Yes.
My name is May. You mentioned the beginner's mind. You said, you know, when you do things over and over again for many years, and then, you know, easy to fall into autopilot mode.
Yes.
How do you identify that? You know, especially for people like me, you know, I'm starting practice. Right now I enjoy this beginner's mind, but then after a while, maybe I shouldn't ask. Anyway, I'm just curious that what make you alert that, I say, oh, you know, I'm in autopilot mode.
Well, for example, you know, we chanted the loving kindness meditation just before. So we also chant that at Zen Center. But sometimes I'll start chanting and suddenly the chant is over and I realize I wasn't paying attention. I was chanting with my voice but not with my whole being. You know, I spaced out. And that can happen in Zazen too. I mean, it often happens. And then that moment of realizing, where was I? Then you're back. So I think it's always, you know, it can happen when you're chopping vegetables or sitting at your computer or whatever you do, but it's very hard to stay present. You know? And I think those moments when we realize, oh, I haven't, you know, I'm just not really fully here, that gives us an opportunity to come back. I love that you're passing the microphone. Sometimes it's really hard to hear questions, and the microphone is great.
Hey, that's Phil. What is Buddhism to you? Like, how to be a faithful Buddhist?
How do
you become a faithful Buddhist?
Well, Buddhism, I mean, the word Buddha,
yeah,
the root of Buddha is, I believe, awake. So I'd say, you know, the Buddha was someone who woke up to many truths about life and was able to teach them. So one of the practices we do is taking refuge in Buddha, taking refuge in Dharma, taking refuge in Sangha. So I think of Buddha or Buddhism, or I'll just say Buddha first, as a practice of waking up, as we were just talking about, that, you know, noticing when I'm not fully present and then trying to be kind of aware of what I'm doing moment to moment, aware of my thoughts and my feelings, my body. It's not, you know, that we have on Han, I heard your Han, I don't know if you have the same thing written on it. Most of it's the wooden instrument that calls us to practice. And one of the things I've written on it is, don't waste your life. Buddhist, my practice, I can't say what Buddhism is for everybody. I mean, Buddhism is a world religion, but that doesn't really explain it. You know, it's more of a real appreciation for life and death and how precious each life is. It's also an awareness of interconnectedness, that we live in not separate from each other and from all beings and from nature, that it's a sense of what we do has a ripple effect. So it's practicing with precepts. I mean, Buddhism is very rich, and I do believe that it's accessible. Everybody has the capacity to wake up and experience their Buddha nature. Well, I don't think it's restricted to meditation. Actually, partly we meditate so that we can carry that sense of being present into everything we do. So you can practice beginner's mind chopping vegetables. We have a kitchen at Zen Center where when we prepare food, we practice functional speech, so we're silent. We're paying attention to what we're doing, how we're holding the knife, what it's like to cut a carrot in, evenly. how to move in the kitchen with other people in a small space. The whole body is involved in that, and I think that's an expression of presence of beginner's mind, trying to be aware of what you're doing moment to moment. It can happen in anything you do, not just in meditation. I think it can all be experienced as beginner's mind if you're doing something with awareness. It doesn't matter what the activity is, whether it's meditation or chopping a vegetable or driving a car or riding a bicycle. And as you know, if you become very proficient at something, it is easier to space out and not notice what you're doing or how your body is feeling. And I mean, I think that's partly when we get into car accidents, just not paying attention. So not paying attention can have serious consequences.
My name is Philippe. And I've been living in the U.S. for 22 years. This is the first time I've ever come across someone who was at Martin Luther King's speech. This is the first time I've come across someone who was at Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So I think that's pretty special. And I was curious about your experience on that day, whether it felt like it was a historical moment or was it just another speech that you were going to see? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
It definitely felt like a historical moment, partly because of coming at the end of that 3 weeks of voter registration and being exposed to the suffering of African Americans in the South at that time. And when our bus arrived in Washington, D.C., there were buses coming from so many different places, and there were children in a bus. They were singing freedom songs. They were from a Prince Edward County, I think, where it was really a struggle for them to have an education. And marching, you know, there were thousands of people, and the energy that day was amazing, and black and white people, there were labor leaders, there were people from different religious backgrounds, people of all ages marching. Definitely felt like a historic moment, and I've never forgotten it. So for me it was very impactful, but I think it was very impactful for the whole country, you know. I think we're living in a historic moment right now, you know? And we know it, we can feel it. Sometimes we don't even know at times when we might be living in a historic moment, but that one definitely felt historic, and being there, not just reading about it.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.